I've been able to make my way in the world and overcome whatever talent deficit gap that I have because I'm willing to and capable of outworking the next guy. And so I've relied on that story to achieve certain successes. And then I credit that story as fundamental to that success. But ultimately, I see myself moving towards burnout and these, you know, having to confront these control issues in a way that I'm now realizing it's not only is it not sustainable, like it's not making me happy.
All right, welcome back or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, and by trade and training, I'm a sport and performance psychologist, and I don't talk about that very much, but I think that sometimes it's a good reminder to remind folks of where my training is actually coming from. And I get all the time, I get folks saying, you ask great questions. Yeah, well, that's the training, like really trying to understand what makes somebody tick, what their framework is, how they see the world, explain events. That's all psychological framework. That's a whole purpose of these conversations with some of the brightest minds in the world and the best doers in the world is what are they searching for? What is their unique way that they understand the world? And what are the mental skills that they use to build and refine their craft? Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing. It just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Now, this week's podcast is unique. It's a follow-up with Rich Roll, who's been on the podcast before, but I'll talk about Rich in just a moment. But this is more of a casual conversation between friends than it is any type of interview. And I speak a lot in this. So this is like a bit different of form and format, and we just go to places. And, you know, Rich is a friend, and each time we have one of these conversations, we always seem to end up taking the conversation somewhere new. And Rich is a plant-powered wellness advocate. He's a best-selling author and an ultra athlete. He's also got his own podcast. And Rich inspired me to actually start this podcast a few years ago after I had like this great conversation with him. And I thought, my goodness, like he really pulled some good stuff out. And like he just had a great way about him. And I thought that other people would enjoy that same experience. And it's like this perfect match of my curiosity and extraordinary stories. So thank you, Rich, for getting this started and building this community. So if you haven't checked out his podcast, make sure you do that as well. And so he was a guest on the Finding Mastery podcast a while back, episode 18. And by trade, he's a lawyer and a stud warrior and an unbelievable swimmer at Stanford. And we predominantly talk about how pain, the pain that he felt in his life, was the main catalyst for all the positive things that he's experienced in his life since. And in this conversation, we share some of our takeaways from guests that we've both had and like what's that been like to be in these conversations with these bright minds. And we discuss how to combat perfectionism and the three pillars of the psychological framework that are really important. And we dive into those: optimism, control, and grit, and what those mean and what the science is and what the art of training those are, and very applied practices. So I hope you enjoy this. I hope you enjoy Rich. Check out his podcast. And with that, let's jump right into this week's conversation with Rich Roll.
Good to see you.
Great to see you.
Thanks for coming out, man. I appreciate it.
What a beautiful place you have.
Thank you, man. Excited to talk to you. I don't know how many conversations we've had, but it's got to be, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 or something like that.
And each one of them for me start out the same way, which is like, where are we going to go?
Yeah, I don't know, but we'll figure it out.
Yeah, it's really good.
I mean, the first thing is that I wanted to know a little bit more about is how this adventure that you're having with the podcast is going for you and evolving. It's really cool. I've watched it grow and I've watched it evolve and I've watched you take risks and try new things, and it's been really cool. And it's exciting to see it connecting with audiences. Like, I feel proud of you.
I was just going to tell the story. I want to just say out loud again, thank you, because what happened was you said, Mike, I'd like to get you on the podcast. And I said, I think I know what a podcast is, but, mm-hmm. And so it was meant to be a good conversation, is how you sold it to me, if you will. And we had a great conversation on, this was like,
it was a long time. It had to be, I don't know, at least 3 years ago, I think.
Yeah, it was for sure. It must have been. And I loved it. And I saw what you were doing. And I got to tell my story. And not that my story matters, but it was wonderful to be able to talk in depth in a real conversation about things that really mattered to me. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'd like to give that gift to other people.
Yeah. And now you're doing it. I mean, I think I even said to you after that, like, you should have, I mean, you said the medium is perfect for you.
It is. You know what happened for me for a long time is that, so as a licensed psychologist, who I work with and the nature of what we talk about is privileged. And so I don't own the rights to any of that. The client does, the patient, if you will. And I don't call them patients. I don't, mm-hmm. Right? Like they're extraordinary humans. And so the word patience has a funny little term to or baggage with it. But so that was all kept in like this working laboratory, very much a sanctuary type experience and relationship. And then so the thought of being able to have a public conversation was never a thought.
Right.
And until you said, no, like, why don't you get some of your friends? Why don't ask your clients?
Well, and also it's just your approach. It's the way you ask questions. It's your curiosity. And it's the ideas that percolate out of those conversations that are applicable in a broad way. It doesn't have to be a patient, doctor relationship.
No, it can't be. Right. No, it can't. And I hope that people that come on Finding Mastery don't feel like that. But I will say that people walk away saying two things. They say that was intense.
Yeah.
And I feel a little better because of it. You know,
and like, a lot of like, no one's ever asked me that question before.
Yeah. But I hear folks on your podcast say the same thing. Like, good question.
Probably not to the extent that they say it to you. And what's funny is that, I mean, we have so much overlap in our guest pool. Like, there's at least a dozen people there's been a multiple occasions where somebody came right from your show and came to me and vice versa the same day.
Twice. For sure it's happened twice. And I always think to myself, like, the competitive part of me, like, damn it, Rich.
You know, I'm always like, I think Anthony Irvin came here right after doing yours. And I was like, oh, he's going to be tired. Michael just put him through the guy's got nothing left, you know?
No, he was awesome. No, didn't he have great energy?
Like, but I love listening to your like, because what you do is similar, but it's very different. And I'm like, oh man, why didn't I think of that? Why didn't I think of that question? And you get to go so deep with these people. Like, you're very gifted at it.
Well, thank you. And I would say, where you take folks is like so organic and so real that attraction pays dividends for listeners. And as a, let's call it, I don't know, what kind of listener am I? I've got like at least three lenses when I listen to others' podcasts, including yours. One is like, I'm a learner. I just want to learn. Another is as a trained psychologist, like to see the depth and the nature and the stuttering and the hesitations or the exuberance to go somewhere. And then the texture of those responses.
Right.
And then as like this quasi-professional, like the linking of questions and the linking of thoughts. So your organic nature, like what's happening right now is
right.
Just,
I mean, you're going to make me self-conscious now.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Because the listening. The laser eyes are upon me.
Oh, like, God, it's so good. No, like, it's not like that. But I've actually had to work, I would say almost my entire adult life for sure. And it probably goes back to earlier to extract judgment and to,
what does that mean?
Like to not judge, mm-hmm. to not be critical. And I think there's a real thought that to become great at something, you need to be critical. I'm not sure that I would ever, now that what I've come to learn would prescribe that is a path.
But there's discernment.
Discernment is different. Yeah, for sure. But the thought like that I'm going to put you under some sort of
right.
Something I'm not critical of myself nor you, like, but I'm really curious about the intensity, the curiosity, the tone, like, where are you going to take the conversation? How am I going to respond? Mm-hmm. And so anyways,
yeah.
You know what I wanted to ask you? I wanted to ask you about, so we both had Alex and Ald on, mm-hmm. and like, I think he's one of the most significant minds in sport right now. And so I'd love to ask you our setup was different. So I had him in a live environment. And so
you were like at USC in front of a huge auditorium.
It was amazing. And so, but it's a different nature when it's a public conversation, you know, there's a little bit of a fishbowl experience. And I'd love to learn, and maybe we can swap notes here, is what you learned. And then, you know, I'd love to share that as well, my perspective.
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say is that I agree with you. I think he's one of the most brilliant athletes walking planet Earth right now. I mean, what he's capable of doing is boggles the mind. And I just think his proficiency and his mastery, to use your word, is on a level that, you know, few athletes are capable of achieving. Like, in a scenario in which the risks and the, you know, could not be higher, right? It's just unbelievable what he's able to do. And I think what I took away from him, well, a couple things. I mean, first of all, you know, speaking of ego is the enemy, there's a tremendous groundedness to him and humility that I would imagine must be due to parenting and the way he was raised, because, you know, you would expect somebody of that stature to carry themselves a little bit differently. So I found that to be very impressive amongst, you know, his many qualities, but I think that stuck with me the most. And I think the other thing was his ability to exercise that discernment so that he can be focused on the things that are most important to him, right? In a world in which he's getting pulled in a million different directions, he has the strength and the will to turn that channel down so that he can do what he's here to do.
Yeah, very cool. I think he, for me, he represented all of that. And I found it to be, there's one other thing, his ability to trust himself.
Mm-hmm.
if he does make mistakes, it's not like he's mistake free, but when he makes mistakes, his ability to adjust and his ability to trust himself to adjust in a very highly consequential environment is like no other, right? There's only handfuls of people and handfuls of environments, workforces, if you will, that is, it's that intense. And I spent some time, brief amount of time, I always have such a high regard for people that put their lives on the line for other people's well-being. And I spent some time on the USS Truman, and it was a dip in and dip out. It's one of the beautiful aircraft carriers, or very intense aircraft carriers, the American Navy. And so it's the most dangerous place to work is on the air deck. Mm-hmm. And when I was talking to, it was the XO, or was it CO? XO, who was one of the two heads of the USS Truman. He was a former pilot. And the way he described to me his craft, he says, "Have you ever been in a car accident?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Do you remember the adrenaline that happened?" I said, "Oh yeah. Like there's a lot of, have you been in one before?"
No.
You have not?
Mm-mm. Other than like a fender bender.
Yeah.
Never been in like a real
Was there adrenaline rush there?
Or was it probably
like, what was that?
Easily, you know, the adrenaline rush is easily triggered. Does that happen? So I would say yes.
Very cool. So he said, so let's say that somebody hasn't had that experience as a car crash. If you can recall what he was trying to conjure up, the most intense adrenaline rush you've ever had, he says his left leg would shake. And here's the story he shared with me. And I'm going to map this back to Alex in just mm-hmm. a second. Is that this is how he was trying to describe the danger in his job and the way it feels, is that he was driving, he and his family, they loaded up a rig and a truck and a fifth wheel, is that what you call it? Like mm-hmm. they were moving and mm-hmm. he was taking some stuff to the new destination and he was tired and he's a tough guy, he says, and he's kind of trying to grind out the fatigue, and he starts to drift out of his lane and he comes back to, and there's a semi screaming his horn coming the other direction. So he swerves just a little bit. I can't remember if it was ice or not. I can't remember that part of the story, but it's like he felt very out of control in this moment. And he's like, okay, I got it. And then all of a sudden his fifth wheel started to parallel with his car. So it was like a, what do you call that? Like a jackknife.
Hydroplane. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was hydroplane, but mm-hmm. the back rig, if you will, was now parallel to his truck.
Right.
So he makes this kind of amazing adjustment, and his truck and fifth wheel straighten out, and the rig just barely misses him, as the dramatic story should end, right? And he pulls off to the side, and he said, if you can imagine what that was like, my legs were shaking, my arms were trembling, I wasn't breathing during that time, but it was amazing, and I was frightened. And he said, that's what it's like every time I try to land on an aircraft carrier.
Wow.
So that intensity will get Alex killed. So that's not what Alex has. And so when we think about dangerous risk takers, dangerous environments, risk takers, that's not the same environment that Alex lives in. That's not his internal system. His internal system, as I've come to understand from many of these folks, is that there's a quietness mm-hmm. with a deep trust. That I know how to get myself out of a jam. I know how to adjust to difficult moments, even when the consequence is potentially limb or life. And I loved it. And at the same time, I thought it was one of the hardest interviews or conversations I had.
Was it? Why?
Because his nickname is No Big Deal.
Yeah.
So Alex, what's it like to have, you know,
sort of deflecting and downplaying.
Your thumb and middle finger in a hole and you're dangling from 2,000 feet. And you've lost your footing on your,
It was cool.
I know. Yeah. Where do you go with that?
It's funny because it's arguably the most extreme amongst the extreme sports, but it isn't. And it's like you said, it's not an adrenaline boosting thing. It's quite the opposite. He has to get himself into this incredible, almost like a trance-like state of extreme focus and calmness. And in terms of like intuition, my sense is that he's just a highly integrated human being. Like he knows how he ticks. He knows why he ticks. And I don't know what process he undertook to understand himself on such a deep level. But I think that is foundational and one of the keys to his success. And I think, you know, in terms of speaking about that more broadly, and I'm interested in what you think about this. Look, you're in the business of talking about peak performance. Everybody wants to be a peak performer, regardless of whether you're sitting in a cubicle or you're an athlete or whatever, a musician.
I don't know if everyone does.
But they're interested in peak performance, right? How can I optimize?
How can I be better? And at the same time, I think there's like this cynical tone as well that takes place, like, oh, okay, peak performance. Like, right. I get both of those. Mm-hmm. And I think I want to hear why you think everyone wants it, because my experience is that most people nod their head that they want to be better, but don't want to do the work. Mm-hmm. And so,
well, that's why all these life hacks are so popular. Yeah, but the idea behind the life hack is, you know, on some level about optimization, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So everyone's looking to, you know, level up, but yeah, they want to do mm-hmm. it the easy way. And so to bring it back around, like the point that I was making is, you know, when you look at someone like Alex, he's able to optimize on such a high level because of that profound level of self-understanding that he has, right? And that's the part people don't want to do. They want to skip that part.
The self-discovery.
Yeah, because
don't get me wound up, right? You know yeah, how I think no, about
like,
hacking.
But no, please, like I want to unleash you on this point because I think yeah. it's super important. I think people look at this and they either don't understand what that means or they find it inconvenient or unnecessary. Like they just want to get to the sexy part, but that's where the work is. And when you see somebody who is so self-actualized as Alex, the proof is in the pudding because his ability to execute on what he cares about is a direct function of that integration process.
Yes. I mean, I'm shaking my head like, yes. And I love that. I love this phrase that someone gave us, this my wife and I, this thought early on, which was parenting is inconvenient. And
super inconvenient.
Super inconvenient. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that's not a bad thought. That is like to do parenting well, you're going to have to maybe leave places that you want to be because you say to your son or daughter, whomever, like, hey, the behavior that you're acting on, it's not okay. And if it continues, we're going to have to leave Disneyland, even though you want to be there or this party that you're at or this, whatever. And if you, the inconvenient, being inconvenienced, not by the human that you're raising, but by the acts that sometimes are untimely. And that's the hard work. That's what actually creates the beautiful bonds between children and adults, is the ability for them to trust, like, okay, they have my best interests, even though it's not easy mm-hmm. now to live through. And you said it was inconvenient for people, or it is inconvenient to do the long, difficult journey of self-discovery. Oh yeah, it's hard, right? It's hard to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do that alone work. Nobody can give you wisdom.
Yeah. And I don't know that I ever would have done it had my back not been up against the wall. You know, pain has always been my motivator to really look inward and make changes.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's Hydrow.com, Hydrow.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydrow.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you go check them out. So I've been asking this question to people lately, and I don't know if it's a fair question, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it. Love to win or hate to lose? And if there was space to choose a third option, would you choose a third option? And or would you just say, oh yeah, it's this one out of those two?
I would choose a third option. For me, it's never about winning or not losing. It's just a function of whether I lived up to what I believe to be my potential. Like, did I do my best? Did I put everything into trying to achieve a certain result?
And then, so that's why I think it's not a fair question. Mm-hmm. And that being said, is the process to better understand what is possible for anybody, for oneself or for somebody else, is difficult. Like that takes discernment. That takes deep thinking. To think about, like, and this, I think this might be one of the most loving thing we can do for another human, is to think deeply about what is possible, have a conversation with that person, calibrate that conversation, nod our heads to it once we get the fabric and the texture of that thought aligned, and then commit to helping, supporting, and challenging that person through. And if we're left alone to do it, it's really hard. That's why I haven't seen anyone that does it alone, right? But back to the thought, hate to lose, love to win. Almost 95% of people that I ask that question to, they, whether they think that they are on the right path or not, no, let me not say it that way. That sounds almost crude. 95% are saying hate to lose. And then given a little bit more space.
Is that true, really?
Yes, but what spurred me on that is your thought, which is I had to come from pain. So the pain of losing, which if we map it on the brain, there's no loss center of the brain. There's grief. There's like, you know, there's no, the redundancies in the brain are minimized because it's this amazing superpower computer that we don't even know really how it works. But the thought that there's a center for losing a Super Bowl or losing an ultra event, there's no center in the brain for that. It is mapped over grief.
Right.
So most people, grief is so hard for people. And then when they go put their butt on the line and go for it in a competitive environment or a vulnerable environment, and they come up short, it feels like grief, and that's hard. And so hating to feel grief is the response. That's how I decode that thought.
Like an avoidant strategy.
Yeah, like I hate it so much, I'll do whatever it takes to relieve myself from it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that that's a beautiful way to do, you know, the process.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. Yeah. So when you sit down with, you know, somebody that you're working with, like, how do you begin to to figure this out and find a different through line to connect with that person to perhaps provide a foundation for a healthier motivation?
Well, we tried to get clear. The first part is that, not first part, but just the value to the discovery process. You know, like, let's just nod our head that the initial part, you're asking me like when I'm doing my craft, is that right?
Right.
Like as a sports psychologist or performance psychologist. Yeah. So the initial, so the way I've structured it is that we spend 8 hours together. That's a long day. Mm-hmm. By the end of the day, we're exhausted. We both are tired because we're working relentlessly towards insight. And then at the end of those 8 hours, if we are so fortunate to have some insight about what makes this, the person that I'm working with, who are they and what makes them work, if you will, what are they driven by and driven toward? And then if we can get a handful of insights together, then we can set up and design a way to train one's mind and organize one's life for optimizing.
Right.
Okay. So that deep, deep work is really like, who are you? Mm-hmm. What are you driven by? What are you driven toward? And then what do you imagine as possible? And so that's,
but in order to really get to the heart of that, it's not just a function of like, oh, what drives you? Oh, I want to win the Super Bowl, or I want to win an Olympic gold medal. Yeah, okay, but is that really what's driving them? Like, you have to get beneath that, right?
Wait, oh, it's like 18 questions yeah, right. beneath that. Like,
so do you have like this like, what's the strategy? Like, how do you begin to pull those layers back and get to the heart of who somebody really is?
You know, what's a fun part that I don't ever talk about is that. Okay, I want to kind of link two things together. One is I was on a recent podcast, I'll keep it nameless, and I got really fiery during the conversation. And I said to the interviewer, I said, you know what it feels like to be on this side of the conversation? It feels like you've grabbed me by my ankles, you've tried to wrestle me to get me upside down and shake out whatever you think is in my head. You know, like trying to get the lint and the coins to come from my pockets and whatever thoughts, you know, that could bang out of my
head.
Trying
to hack you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said, that's not how this works. It doesn't work like, what are the four questions? And I know that you're not asking that. Mm-hmm. You're asking a really thoughtful, like, what is the process underneath? And so I want to share something that I think you might enjoy, right? So let's say I ask an innocuous question, like, kind of a, not something amazing, but it's a curious question. So it's authentic, okay? So what's happening for me is I'm standing on the shoulders of titans of research in the field of psychology. And I'll remind you that from our last conversation, just as a stopgap here, is that I can't get enough of it. Like, I can't read enough of it. Mm-hmm. I love how complicated the mind is. And so all of the research and reading that goes into, it's like, what are the theories? Where are they strong? What are they missing in their approach? What are the applied practices that have been studied around it? So I've got all of that I'm trying to forget, but I need to stand on those shoulders. Okay. Then I'll ask a question based on a particular paradigm or theory. And then what I'm doing is I'm just watching and feeling. So I feel myself. I got to get myself out of the way. Cause if I'm anxious, they can pick it up. You know, we can smell stress. Mm-hmm. We can see it in micro expressions. And so if I'm stressed out right now, your natural response in your brain is to go, well, if he's stressed, maybe I should be stressed.
Yeah.
If his brain is picking up something dangerous, maybe there's something at stake here. And so then that becomes problematic. So I've first got to get myself out of the way by being where my feet are, right? Being curious as opposed to judgmental. Ask the question. And then, without trying to bait a response or trying to guess where it's going, be in it. And then use both silence and observation to be able to toggle, this is the part I wanted to share, toggle up or down the amygdala activation. So the amygdala is part of the brain that is like the emotional kind of fight, flight, freeze, submission, or flow state responses. And that last one is asterisk. You know, there's not enough research around it right now. Okay, so just providing enough stress where their brain lights up, but trying to figure out if we've crossed that threshold where the brain begins to shut down, thinking clearly and emotional, thinking clearly becomes compromised because the emotional center of the brain is too active. So that is like the art.
You're like turning these dials, yeah, sort of, right?
Yeah. Well, that sounds dangerous, yeah, but no. It's more uh-huh. like I'm not turning them. I'm trying to be the filter, like the receiver of them. And then if I ask just this question and say it in this kind of way, what happens? And as soon as somebody begins to maybe get angry or break out in a sweat or find a sense of relaxation or peace, it's like, oh, look, what just happened? And so mm-hmm. then we use the experience in the room mm-hmm. to work to calibrate. Mm-hmm.
And when you're doing that like probing process, I mean, part of that I would imagine has to do with finding a way in, like, how can I, like, what are the levers here that I can play with to motivate this person to, you know, unleash, you know, perhaps potential that's hidden within them. And I would imagine you're going to come across some levers that would work, but are unhealthy. Like, oh, this guy, you know, I don't know, you know, he hates his dad. So I can play with that and I could get him to, you know, really, you know, I could perhaps get him to a new level in his, whatever his expertise is, but that's ultimately not a sustainable methodology, right?
I love it. You know, okay. So one of the thoughts is there's an assumption that I'm making. Is that you hold all of your insights. You are the container of wisdom as well. So there's nothing I'm going to say that is going to provide wisdom. Like, it's already inside you. We just need to figure it out. Everything you need is already inside you is the basic assumption. And you said, like, to help motivate people. I don't think so. I don't think that's – I'm not in the right business to help motivate people, because the folks that I spend time with are highly driven, like the – percenters in the world driven. And so I think that part of the process is to create more space for the fire to burn more brightly. Mm-hmm. Right. And then how do you do that? Well, each thought, this is a hypothesis, right? Thoughts lead to thought patterns. Thought patterns lead to thought habits. Once they become habits or habitual, they move just below for an, what's the word I'm looking for? They move below the surface for, what's the word I'm looking for? Like efficiency. Right, sorry. Okay. Yeah. So there's just like physiological patterns, right? So from thoughts to thought patterns to habits. And then once they're a habit, they're below surface. So part of it is reminding them of the habits that they've already built. They've already had great success. Mm-hmm. Every human has. They've already figured out how to get out of jams. You know, people have done. So let's use what's already below the surface and above the surface to figure it out. Now, if we reverse engineer that, each thought either creates space or tension. I'm going to oversimplify it, right? But if that, just with that thought alone, if you can become more aware of your thoughts, and then is this particular thought that you're having right now, Rich, because you're having thoughts, I'm having thoughts, and we're having a conversation. And the better this conversation goes is a direct relationship to the amount of thoughts that are not present, mm-hmm. right?
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So every thought that we have is either creating constriction or expansion. And I learned that from Judson Brewer, who's a beautiful mind in the contemplative mindfulness research space. And it's like, yes, that's it. That's exactly it. And so that simple little insight, I think, really is how the process works.
So walk me through like an example of that.
Okay,
you know what I mean? Like, sure. Like, I don't know, like in your experience of working with the people, you obviously not naming names, but is there like, I'm trying to
I ask you a question?
Because it sounds very ephemeral. You're going to turn this on me, aren't you?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Let's go to work. All right. So let's talk about, I don't know, something that you're working on building. Something that you're trying to figure out. What would that be?
I'm trying to, let's see, that's a good question. Well, I'm trying to figure out how to create better systems around the work that I do so that I can do it in a more sustainable way without being drained. Okay. So that I can approach my work with enthusiasm and awe and wonder and excitement.
Okay, so where's the draining come from?
It comes from a couple things. It comes from control issues. It comes from holding myself to an unreasonable perfectionist standard.
And when you are like thinking about needing to be perfect and having a high standard that way, what are those thoughts?
I think that's driven by...
No. What are the actual thoughts?
Oh, the actual thoughts of... The actual thoughts are, this isn't good enough. I can make it better. I can make it better.
That's it, Rich. That's the thought. That's the thought that creates... So perfectionism is a constricting-based thought, right? It creates tightness, both mentally and physically. You probably feel it. If we stayed there long enough, you would be like, yeah, I'm all wound up. Because, my God, if I put this product into the world and it's not good enough, I'm going to be judged as hard as I'm afraid that... I'm going to feel that other people are judging me as hard as I'm judging myself. And it feels awful when I judge myself at that standard.
Which is what I do all the time.
That's right. So that creates constriction. And what that does is it just puts a little sand in the groove, right? It just doesn't allow the grease to work quite as well. So that's simple. That's really simple. So then what's the applied tactic? Is become more aware of that thought, because that becomes a thought pattern. Become as soon as you grab that thought.
I have good self-awareness around it. Mm-hmm. I'm just paralyzed from actually implementing changes.
Well, we talked about this 3 years ago.
No, see? This is what I'm telling you. Implementation is my problem.
Well, for all of us, though. So, you know what's really cool about this nature of the conversation? Me too. Okay? So, I grew up super self-critical. I came from a family, from an ecosystem, from a community that supported that somehow. No one wants their children to be self-critical, you know? Well, strike the word no one. There are some families that think that that is the right way. And let me kind of pull out this conversation for a minute. I have a 9-year-old and I see the competitive sport landscape. My son is more on the artistic side right now than the sport side or the athletic side. And I see where some parents, and I'm not saying that they're my son's friends, but I just see the ecosystem of young parents and young children. And the ones that are screaming on the sidelines are not the ones that did it in the pros.
Of course not.
No. So the ones that have done it in the pros, they're in the corner with their hat down going, God, I hope he's having fun.
Yeah, of course. I mean, because they're fulfilled. They're not living out their childhood fantasy through some projection on their child.
And they know that to really go the game of mastery with a stop short of that, which would be high performance, to really go to that place, it takes a long time. Mm-hmm. And if you don't love it, you're not going to go a long time. And if you're, let's say high performance is stop 1,000. I'm making up how many stops are on this train, 1,000. Mastery is like 2,000, right? So the stop of 1,000, most people want to get off around 250 now, because it's so freaking hard to be deeply focused. Because when you're deeply focused, you know what you have to do? You have to gate out the thoughts that create constriction. To be deeply focused in this moment where all things amazing happen, high performance, love, intimacy, vulnerability, all the amazing things happen in the present moment, as you well understand that of being your friend and listening to your thinking patterns. So we have to gate out all the ones that create constriction that become noisy. So you think about the signal to noise ratio. The signal is where amazing things take place, and it's always found in the present moment. And the noise are the self-critical thoughts.
Right.
You need to be perfect, this, that, and the other. And the noise of what others might think of us. Those are both noisy.
So what is the process of muting the self-critical voice?
So it's not a mute, right? It's a relationship with it. It's a relationship with, and there's lots of ways to do this, but it's the relationship with, why am I doing that? Okay, that's interesting. Oh, look, there it is again. So it's increasing the awareness, being curious about why you would choose that thought, and then making a decision. As soon as I do have that thought, what am I going to do about it?
Right. Well, I think it's even deeper than that, because at least in just speaking for myself, and I've seen this with other people, these behavior patterns that are perhaps, leading us astray can be part and parcel of our identity, and also what we imagine or project are crucial aspects of our success equation. So I can easily make the argument, for example, that my perfectionist standard, my control issues, that's how I was able to even get here to this place where I get to sit here and talk to you. And if I let go of that, that's very threatening. That's terrifying, right? Because that means that I have to come to this decision that that is in fact not what's fueling my success. And just coming to that understanding is difficult. And it would then put me in a place of confusion and mystery.
Okay. So what you're hitting on is big time, right? It's almost like what would be an easy example is that, you know what? Okay, I have a headache. And so the doc or someone that I trust told me to take aspirin. Do you take aspirin for headaches?
If I get a headache, I don't get headaches that much. But
no, I was asking that like more
Advil
rhetorically.
Or whatever
yeah. It is, right? You take something for a headache. Mm-hmm. And then it works. You're like, oh, okay, good. Okay. And then at some point you say, man, I got a stomachache. You go into the doc for the stomachache and they go, you know what? Let's do a little test. Oh, you've got some ulcers. How often do you take, you know, the headache medicine? Well, I take it 3 times a day. No. You gotta stop doing that. It's too much, but it works. I don't have headaches, but now you have an ulcer. So it's a little bit like this system that got you here. And I see this all the time. The system that got me to a certain phase of my life, even this phase of my life, has worked, but there's limitations. And I see it with like world-class athletes that say, you know, what got me here? I've got 2 gold medals. I've got, you know, this, that, and the other accolades, but there's another space that I need to figure out. Because this is no longer working anymore. And so it's like now the question is, do you stop taking the medicine?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Because the initial pattern was that you had headaches. So now you got to figure out how to not have ulcers and not have headaches.
Yeah, I think that reminds me of my conversation with Kerry Walsh Jennings, who you know well. That idea that like in the context of athletic performance, like, oh, the way that you become successful is you live this monastic life and all you do is train. And then, you know, as you grow older, life gets more complicated. And if you want to continue in your career, you have to provide the space to let other things into your experience. And that can be frightening, right? It's like, no, the only way that I can win gold medals is if I live alone in a hut in the woods, right? And then to come into an understanding that actually you might even be better if you let go of that idea. That idea may have gotten you to this place, but it's not going to take you through 3 more Olympiads.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something, it's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course, that's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTru.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. So there's two components that we're talking about. The journey of self-discovery, and I'd love to unpack that a bit. And then what we're talking about right now is a psychological framework. So both are foundational to be able to have a strong base to explore. Psychological framework really is, how do I understand the world? How do I understand myself? How do I make rational and clear sense of events that take place in my life? And there's 3 basic buckets for a psychological framework that I'm really fascinated by that have been thematic. One is optimism versus pessimism. And what I've found, like research would support this as well, there's lots of good research around optimism and pessimism. Not a whole lot about pessimism, but in reference to optimism. And then my personal life experiences, I don't know any, and that sounds like a really big phrase, but I don't know any world-class performers that don't believe the future is going to work out well.
Yeah, but my first question is that immutable? Like, there are pessimistic people and there are optimistic people. Can you take somebody who has a victim mentality or a pessimistic outlook on life and turn them into an optimistic
person? I cannot do it. They need to want to do it. So they need to understand, like, the process for all of us to change is to mm-hmm. feel the pain of the current situation. And this is why drugs are so gnarly, is because they take away the pain, right? And buying something can take away some pain. You know, it can give you some instant pleasure.
That may deprive you from that pivotal moment in which you are forced to look at yourself and perhaps make that change that could make all the difference.
There it is. So I can't help somebody change, right? They have to want to do it. My job in many cases is to help them feel pain.
But even let's assume they have that willingness.
The clear answer is yes. We are not born, as the leading hypothesis about optimism, pessimism, is we're not born. We don't come into the world that way. There might be a genetic predisposition towards anxiety and whatever that would gate somebody a little bit closer to pessimism, but it's a learned behavior. Mm-hmm. And so anything that's learned can be adjusted and adopted. So the first is to know that there's options. And part of that process is to recognize how many of the extraordinary doers in the world think. And they're more optimistic than pessimistic, just by my experience, if we're just taking an N of one right now. And then the challenge in this conversation is, as soon as people talk about optimism, it sounds like all of a sudden we're going to get soft. All of a sudden we're going to get, you know, let's hold hands and let's pick some flowers together and everything's going to work out just right. That's not what optimism is. Optimism, we think that optimism is at the center of mental toughness, to have the mental discipline to be able to stay the course when the shit is not going right. Mm-hmm. That's the thing right there.
Well, it's fortitude. It takes a tremendous amount of faith and composure to say, I'm going to devote like this huge part of my life to this goal, whether it's professional or athletic or whatever it is. Baked into that has to be some sense that this is going to lead you in a positive direction, right? That things are going to work out, maybe not exactly as you imagine, but that it'll deliver you to a place that's better than wherever you are at that moment.
That's exactly right. Okay. So then at some point, how do you chip in? Right? How do you really trust yourself? How do you trust that whatever it is that you're going, whatever bet you're going to play, that it's going to work out? And if it doesn't work out, you have the ability to figure it out. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've got optimism. We've got locus of control. And then we've also got grit. And those are three pillars in the psychological framework that I think are really important to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. So grit, as you know, from Angela Duckworth, passion, perseverance for long-term goals. Control, the locus of control. Like, are you controlling what's 100% in your control? Are you working towards that or caught up in the noise of the other things that are really important, but you can't control? And getting those three cobbled together on a consistent basis, that's a nice, significant piece of work to have some durability on the long play in life.
One of the things that you talk about a lot that is just one of my favorite subjects is this idea that we become the stories that we tell about ourselves. Yeah. Those become predictors of future behavior and outcomes. And I would imagine in the same way that, you know, on the scale of optimism and pessimism, that these stories are mutable. I know they're mutable. But they're very powerful, right? So in your kind of inquiry earlier, I was thinking about some of the stories that I've historically told myself. And a lot of them are around this idea that I don't think I'm that talented, but I have this huge like work ethic capacity. I know how to suffer. I know I actually like suffering. I like, you know, I have like, it's all imagined, you know, and it plays out as truth, but I've been able to make my way in the world and overcome whatever talent deficit gap that I have because I'm willing to and capable of outworking the next guy. And so I've relied on that story to achieve certain successes. And then I credit that story as fundamental to that success. But ultimately, I see myself moving towards burnout and these, you know, having to confront these control issues in a way that I'm now realizing it's not only is it not sustainable, like it's not making me happy, right? And I have this sense that I could be more productive and I could be happier and more fruitful if I let go of this narrative and find a new one.
Cool. I mean, that's like if we're swinging from vines together, and you've got a bead on how this vine is creating great momentum for you. And then you grab the next one. It's not quite as sturdy, but you know you need to let go of the one that's really strong and it's got some good oomph mm-hmm. behind it, you know, and it's got a good anchor and lever on it to go to the new one that's a little less sturdy, but you think it's going to take you in the right direction. Like, what if you fall? You know, can you figure it out? And I'm not looking at you that way. I'm saying for all of us. Uh-huh. So there is, you know, rational emotive therapy is like, take a look at the worst case scenario. Feel that. Really examine the worst case scenario. And oftentimes what happens if you go in that kind of dark place, if you will, and even write it down or talk about it with someone that you really trust, is that you end up coming through going, well, the chances of that happening are pretty low because I'm pretty resourceful. But if it did, I'd rather go for it than not go for it. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's something in there that ends up happening for people. But the thought that, yes, can they change? 1,000%. And you go back to the constriction thoughts or the expansion thoughts. You know when you belly laugh? It's really good. And like, it just feels really good. That's space. That's expansion in there. And so those thoughts that lead to the freedom to have that type of experience on a regular basis, wouldn't you trade a lot of that for like, I don't know, whatever quote unquote success is? You know, outwardly success, yeah. isn't that like really valuable?
And
if we follow, like Harvard did that 75-year study on fulfillment, and that's a long study now, 75 years, right, to study fulfillment. And what they found, two of the largest pillars for fulfillment in life is grokking and wrestling with the difficult questions in life. So not shying away from, this is a difficult question we're talking mm-hmm, about. Mm-hmm. And I think we have, and the other one is deep relationships.
It's like Susan David. Mm-mm. She's a Harvard psychologist who wrote this book, Emotional Agility.
I do. I know the book.
Yeah. But it's that idea. Like her saying is, what is it exactly? I'm going to butcher it. But like essentially grappling with difficult emotions is the price you pay for a meaningful life.
That's right.
So this success, like the idea of being fulfilled and contented in your life requires you to face these things that, you know, kind of our culture pushes up against and says, don't worry about that, or take this pill, or, you know, just pretend it didn't happen.
And I think what's happening right now, if we kind of map less than 100 years, like from the Industrial Revolution to now, is that our ancestry at some point figured out that no machine's going to take their job. So they came home to the dinner table and they said, you know what? No machine's taking our job. We're going to work. We're going to figure it. Not in this house. Mm-hmm. And so we've been handed down that work ethic ethos. You and I certainly have, but many people have been handed that down. And then what it's turned into over time, as a generation of the has muted the story, or not muted, but shifted the story just a little bit, is that I need to do extraordinary things to be extraordinary. So the thought that I need to do more to be more, I think, is wearing us out.
Yeah. Well, I've definitely bought into that.
Yeah. And so you're not alone, right? Yeah. Yeah. But so there's a deep fatigue that will come from that mm-hmm. model. And it's time for sure right now. I think the timing of this is eloquent, that let's flip the model, that we need to be more and let the doing flow from that place. So the be more what? Be more present, be more authentic, be here more often, be more gracious, right? Be more. And then whatever the doing that we want to experience in life, imagine the output difference. One is you get those mm-hmm. moments in joy, you increase maybe the frequency of them. And then what would happen to the doing if they came from a more pure place?
Right. That's uncharted territory for me, because I've always been the guy who you know, my operating system is, if I didn't like really suffer to create whatever I'm creating, then I didn't work hard enough at it. You know, there's more, I can extract more blood from that stone, you know, just a couple more all-nighters, you know, like, and I can make it, you know, 0.0001% better, you know, and it's not working.
Well, it got you here.
I mean, yeah,
it got you wherever.
Well,
you know?
It works. It's mm-hmm. just not, it's not a sustainable fuel source. Right.
And ultimately, there, you know, we're not fragile. Humans are not fragile. We can do extraordinary things to this frame of ours. But we do need to refuel.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how long can you go without sleep? You can do it for a little bit, but not too long. How long can you go without water? Not that long. You know, food, you can go a while. So we can do extraordinary things to our body that are debilitating our resources. But that's not the big goal. Mm-hmm. Right. So then what are the big movers for you? Like, what is it that you want to do in life that's driving you into, you know, I don't know, fatigue?
I mean, I think that fundamentally it's trying to find ways to provide the most help that I can to the most people in the most substantive way, the most meaningful way. That's what gets me excited. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning. Like, I love the training and all the race, whatever. I did all those, but the doing all of that, you know, in some bizarre, you know, alchemy of the galaxy has put me in this place now where now I can be a resource for other people, and trying to be the best at that I can possibly be is what I'm focused on.
I love the thought, you know, walk the talk, you know, like talk about it, but walk about it. And you're talking about how you want to walk about it. You know, you want to live that way, whatever that way is for you. That's like sturdy and nimble all mm-hmm. in the same, you know, way.
And I feel that at the same time, like, so much of your work is about presence, you know, how can you be more in the moment? How can you create that space? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, these conversations are coming up more and more in my life, and they're transpiring in a cultural moment in which we've never been more distracted, and the demands on our attention have never been greater. Like, you know, with these things in our pocket, it's like, there's no space. There's no, anytime you're waiting in a line, you can easily, you know, find something to do with your phone. And so you have to exercise a lot more diligence around creating that space.
We're outmatched. You know, like, technology companies that are really on it have tens to hundreds of PhDs that really understand the neurology of behavior, the thinking patterns of we're outmatched.
Yeah. Do you know this guy, Tristan Harris?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's doing a lot of work around that.
That's right. We're completely outmatched. And, you know, he's on it. He's early in the days of it, and he's going to take on some tech giants around it. And, but I will say that, let's say I'm bullish on technology. I think that, like, yes, we need to move in that direction, but knowing that there's a counterbalance. So I feel the same things that you do, like the draw to the dopamine hit by checking my phone, by trying to catch up with the onslaught of emails that come through. And yes, yes, yes. At the same time, it feels irresponsible to not carve out enough time to train deep focus, because that's like a multitask, thin slicing, you know, rip and run type of experience. So then the counterbalance needs to be space to be able to condition my mind to be more present, to be more aware of what's actually happening in the internal ecosystem. And I'll tell you what, for me at least, there's a razor's edge to it. It's freaking hard to be truthful and honest, and the vulnerability, even when nobody else is around, to be vulnerable with oneself is hard. And so I've been fascinated by the razor's edge. That was my early fascination about sport. So working in hostile and rugged and extreme environments, if you will. And what I've also come to value is that some of the most intense environments are the ones that we have within just ourselves.
You're sitting at home alone. There's nobody at home. You can do whatever you want. What are you going to do?
Exactly.
And that's the ultimate battleground, right?
But like, when you create enough space to listen to that inner experience, that inner dialogue, that inner narrative, whatever you want to call it, which is, you know, it's a human experience, you learn some stuff about yourself you don't want to be reminded of. You don't want to remember that you're a coward, that you're dishonest, that you're afraid that you're going to be exposed. And I'm checking the list for things that I don't want to say about me. And I'd like to play the game that those are not me. Those are for other people. That's me too now. And it's hard, because you know what we want? We want to be noble. We want to be courageous. We want to be caring. We want to be great as a human, as a doer and a beer. And you know, you can't get there without some real discerning honesty.
What do you consider to be your biggest challenge at the moment? I mean, since the last time we talked, your profile is growing, your podcast is growing, you're on stage interviewing people, and you're, you know, counseling Fortune 500 companies and professional sports teams and Olympians. Like, what is it that you struggle with that you're trying to work through?
Being present. I mean, it's the same thing. You know, it's like signal to noise ratio. And so, like, in the weeds, it's like, what are the most tactical decisions that set a course? And so as a business person, making those decisions with my team is challenging. You know, and so that's part of it. No one has to pay me to do performance. Like, I love it. Like, the performance psychology and like being a craftsman, I love it. But there is a cost to it. Let's be clear. The reason there's a cost to it, because it pulls me away from other loves. You know, it pulls me away from time with my family. And so there is a business model that's at play, but I love it. I made a commitment to never charge a kid again. You know, never charge a family structure again. And so I'm not doing that. I'm kind of laughing because I don't have time at this point, you know, right? But so I have two clients a month, is how I set up the crafts part of my job that I talked about earlier. But the harder things that I'm trying to sort out is like the business decisions that are happening real time and very quickly, that keeping up with the momentum feels like we're running downhill, which is a great place to be. But at any given point in time, it feels like I could easily slip, skid my, you know, elbows, leave some blood on the turf. And, you know, so I don't want to be anywhere else, but those are the challenges. And then, you know, even internally in our business, like Coach Carol and I from the Seattle Seahawks, we've built this business together, is like getting the culture of our business right is challenging as well. You know, we're highly thoughtful and ambitious people that have independent thinkers. Like, how do you get all of our noses to line up in the same way? That's not easy too.
And so what is it that you're trying to achieve? Like, what is the legacy that you aspire to?
Yeah, I was going to ask you the same question. And
I asked you first.
I know. And I'll answer it. And I'll say it tongue in cheek, like 1 in 7. And so 1 in 7 people would be this amazing idea to to help. Let me start where this thought originated. So we're working with a world-class organization, and the CEO, Satya Nadella, says, this is like, I'd love this for 100,000 people, you know, and that's like, whoa, you know? And so we started really small. We incubated small. Mm-hmm. And so the thought going into that was like, okay, well, how do we get to 1 in 7 in the organization? And if we can get to 7, or I've been thinking 1 in 5. The first thought was 1 in 5 because everybody has 5 friends, you know, like that thought.
Right.
And so, but I think the number is probably 1 in 7 if we really want to have larger impact outside of one business. So let's just use the 1 in 5 for example right now. 1 in 5 people in Microsoft. Then what about 1 in 5 people in another company? What about 1 in 5 people on the West Coast of America? What about 1 in 5 people in America? And what if we could do 1 in 5 people over 2 continents? Like, would that be crazy? That would be crazy.
And what is it that you're trying to do with that 1 out of 5?
There's only 3 things. There's only 3 things that we can train as humans. We can train our craft, our body, and our mind. And what if 1 out of 5 people, we can help increase the frequency of them living in the present moment by showing them not just the value of it, but how to train and condition your mind to manage the noise, to get to the signal more often, because the signal, the present moment is where it's found, is where the most extraordinary experiences in life happen. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes, for me, this really beautiful thought about a pebble in a pond. And if we can get that pebble to resonate in the right way, the ripple effect, the relationships that people have with other people, it feels like it's extraordinary and wonderful. And, you know, there's a business on the back of that for sure.
Yeah.
I'm not lost on that. But that's what we want to do. 1 in 5 people, show them and hold them accountable and love them and support them and challenge them to condition and train their mind to be more present, to be more, to do more.
I like how clear you are on that.
Oh, yeah.
You've definitely thought that through.
Yeah. 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 I mean, and that's where the Finding Mastery podcast has been like this fun accelerant to it. Uh-huh. Now, in the podcast, there are high level conversations. You know, we don't get too deep into the weeds of how, but there are certainly things we can talk about today, but like there's certainly some very practical things that we can all do to set us down that path a little bit further. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things you talk about a lot is the importance of having a philosophy, right? Like, what is your life philosophy? And if you can't articulate that, then there's some work to be done there, right? So when I ask you about legacy and you answered the way that you did so eloquently, is that different from, like, if I asked you what's your philosophy, is it similar or?
No, that's a cool question. No. So what I described is not necessarily legacy at all. What I described is a mission. Mm-hmm. So I actually have a little bit of an aversion to the thought of legacy because it feels like, to me, when I think of the word legacy, I think about what other people will think about me when I'm gone. I don't care. Like I'm not motivated or driven by that in any shape or form, but I do have this insatiable mission that feels right for me and my family to go on this mission together. And I'm not alone on this. My wife is like, whew, you know, like, I mean, since we were 16, you know, like
you guys have been together forever, right?
Yeah. And she's got her path and I've got my path, but it's a commitment that we make together. There's been lots of sacrifices, you know, that we've made together. Like for 18 years, every Saturday night, I was in a sweaty gym with about 100 athletes trying to sort out my craft. So that's 18 years. Every Saturday night, we didn't have date night. Mm-hmm. Like what an angel, you know, like seriously, like, wow, thank you, Lisa. You know, so there's that part. But for me, it feels like a mission, not about a legacy. But a philosophy are the guiding principles that help me line up my thoughts, my words, and my actions to have true alignment with the mission.
Right.
So a philosophy is different. Those are the principles. The mission is like, what am I hungry for? And so those are the two. And the mission that I just described, you can have a couple missions. They need to hang together. You know, thinking about being a world-class swimmer and then a world-class pianist is probably not going to quite work out in the right way.
Right.
But so I've got a couple submissions, or the way I think about it is like, that's my main business mission. I've also got a mission as a relationship-based man, a spiritual man as well. So, but I feel like I'm getting in the weeds a little bit to answer your question.
Right. But so in thinking about that, like I'm just thinking about how like that clarity of thought about the mission works with this idea of being rooted in the present. Like, are you somebody who's like, okay, here's my 5-year plan and here's how it's going to map out? Or are you somebody who is like, look, I trust when here's my philosophy, here's my mission, and I'm showing up for it, and then I adapt in the circumstances that present themselves. And I don't stay wed to, like, it has to look a certain way a year from now or 5 years from now.
Oh, yeah. That's a cool thought, isn't it? Like, especially how quickly technology is changing. But I do know, I don't know how to answer that. And you know my history well enough that I got out of high school with not a clue what to do. I got out of my first year of my first college with bachelor's degree with not a clue what to do. Mm-hmm. I dropped out of my master's program because it wasn't right. I thought it was going to be. I got out of my, and then I went back to a different school, a different course of study. I got out of my master's program without really a clue to do. My last semester of my master's program, and the dean of the school says, Mike, everyone else has signed up for PhD programs. What are you doing? And I said,
I'm going surfing.
Yeah, really? And I said, no, I'm not cut out to be a PhD. Mm-hmm. She said, you're summa cum laude. What are you talking about? Go anywhere you want. And so I don't have this great ability to say the vision that I'm setting by hell or high water, that's what's going to happen. But I do have a sense that of what the world, my world, and people that I care about, what their world would look like if 1 in 5 people in our ecosystems were more deeply connected to each other in the present moment, like how extraordinary that would be. Mm-hmm. So I have that thought, which is a cool thought for me. That's the vision that I'm holding to. Now, the tactics to get there, 2 years ago, I didn't think we were going to have the challenge that we're having on cascading and what's the word I'm looking for to, like the cascade, like to take the ideas and be able to spread them across many different ecosystems. So we're trying to figure out the right technology to do that as well. So I don't have the tactic like it's going to be this,
right?
But you know,
right.
So that's where we are right now.
I like it, man. It's ambitious, but there's so much heart in that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I want to figure it out, you know? So, okay. So now over to you.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Okay. So what you started with legacy, you know, and I'm not critical at all. If you say like, no, I think about legacy. Like I'd like to hear how you think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know that I think about legacy. I think about, and this is always evolving for me, and it's certainly changed even in the years since I first met you. You know, like I said earlier, you know, what excites me is trying to activate people in a positive way, in a real way, like in a way that can really catalyze significant, sustainable change in them. And initially it began with diet and, you know, through telling my story and helping people rethink the limits of their own personal potential. But I'm starting to think of it more broadly, and I'm trying to kind of transcend this like vegan athlete, you know, sort of story. And the podcast experience in that, this adventure that I've been on, you know, the last 5 years, I've been exposed to so many extraordinary people, and it's given me the opportunity to be a cipher for incredible ideas that I think can be transformative to people. And when I kind of take a look at culture and society, like I don't see a very good picture. You know, we're this incredibly prosperous society, but most people are unhappy. We're overly medicated. 70% of us are obese or overweight. We're dropping dead from diabetes and heart disease and cancer and all of these conditions that are part and parcel of this modern world that we live in. And it's more than a malaise. It's a cultural disease. And so, you know, my work and my mission and my interest stems from trying to get people to wake up from whatever waking dream that they're living in, to seize more autonomy over the direction of their life. And it can begin with food, it can begin with mindfulness, it can begin with exercise. There's many points of entry, but to the extent that I can find a way to connect with people that listen to the podcast or read my books or hear me talk, to activate them to rethink their preset ideas that are based on social programming, to exercise more domain over that. Like, that's what I'm interested in. And it's not nearly as eloquent or well thought out as yours, but that's kind of where my head's at, I guess. Amorphous way.
So I had the same thought, like, okay, he's thought about that. Mm-hmm. And you know what might be fun for us to do is a project together. So I like when people say, yeah, it's a cool idea. And I love when people say, that's a bad idea. Because I say yes to a lot. Like, I like to have ideas. So if mm-hmm. it's a bad idea, please, I would love if you said it's a bad idea. Okay? We don't have the time to waste, you know, on just okay ideas. Okay. But what if we put a little challenge together and we did a philosophy challenge? And so the word philosophy can sound daunting. It can sound like this ivory tower experience. It's not. It's like, what are the guiding principles? And maybe what if we walked both of our communities through in some way in a challenge to write down their philosophy and to do it in a way that maybe in all the, so here's the challenge, right? In all the words of your native tongue, can you choose something that's 25 words or less? Hopefully less, because the litmus test for us is, can you get your philosophy out in a dark alley under duress, right? That's when you know it's really real. And so, like, can you get it out? And then can you act on it? Okay. Mm-hmm. So, but what if we could start with the thinking part and have some sort of contest or challenge? I don't know how to do this. You're better at this than I am, where people submit or do something. And we create a community of people that are switched on about your idea, like to activate, to wake them up in some sort of way. But they actually do the work to say, what is my philosophy? And they write it down. And then I don't know. I don't know what to do from there. But I do know that it is a significant, I mean, and I've said that word a few times, but it's a really nice thing to add to the progressive way of living. In when I say progressive, I mean creating as much space and expansion internally as you can, so you can play, so you can be free. And I feel like that's a really significant way to do it. So
I love that idea. Yeah, I think that's cool. Like, how would we do that? I guess, I mean, you could create some kind of portal where people could share these things. Are you thinking like a public forum where everybody's?
Well, okay. So let's say that 20,000 people.
Closed group or something like that.
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, but I'd like to do this together. Uh-huh. And like, we'll just walk through what a philosophy is. Maybe we'll do it on a separate conversation and we'll just fire that up.
Right.
Send it out. People will, like, we can send them some sort of documentation on how to do it or think about it. And I don't want to have a competition who's the best philosophy.
No,
all going to come down to like a
but
couple.
But just getting people to think about that and practice that, I think, could be really powerful.
Yeah. And then getting their loved one or someone they work with, get their philosophy. So one of the things we've done at Microsoft is we've asked people to write their philosophy down and then ask the people that they work with what their philosophy is, because it's born on this idea that if we're going to go do difficult things together, right, to do the extraordinary is going to be difficult. There's no shortcut to it. Like, you're going to meet some rough waters, that we need to lock arms with each other. And when we lock arms, we want to keep them locked when it gets difficult and not save our own ass and grab, unlock to, you know, like, that's not how we're going to move through life into the, you know, to the uncharted territory. So it's an accelerant to relationships, mm-hmm. and relationships, tightly bonded relationships that are mission minded and really understand the deeper parts of what and why we are who we are. We found that to be an accelerant to performance. And that's Coach Carroll's model.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to be a window into, you know, how people think and operate too. Mm-hmm. Like, when you force somebody to actually write that down, because we project our ideas of people onto everybody we meet, right? We assume they have the same philosophy that we do, you know?
And they don't. Do you know?
Yeah, it's like, and you don't know until you're in a sticky situation and the practice of that philosophy, you know, becomes manifest and you realize, oh, we're not on the same page at all.
That's right. And so there's a lot of assumptions. There's a lot of biases that we have when we're interpreting behaviors and thoughts and nonverbal thoughts or nonverbal actions. Is that right? Nonverbal
actions.
What is that? Yeah, there's a lot of assumptions we make. So doing the work ahead of time is like front loading the relationship to be able to go the distance with each mm-hmm. other. And so if we could find something, I'd love to do that.
Yeah, well, we could talk about it after this and then maybe in the introductory part of this or whatever, we can leave a call to action for people.
That's cool.
Which would be cool. When you present people with that question, I would imagine there's a lot of people who've never been asked that question before and don't even know how to begin to answer it. Hmm. Yeah. So if somebody's listening to this and they're like, yeah, I don't know what my philosophy is.
Well, there's a couple ways to get started. One is there's no right and wrong. It's an authentic expression of the principles that matter most to you. So it is born from you. That being said, there are easy examples of philosophies at play in action. And so we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can adopt somebody's philosophy that has been forged, you know? And so let's take a look at spiritual leaders or political leaders and like, what is their philosophy? Mm-hmm. And the reason you know someone's philosophy is because across environments, friendly environments to hostile environments, they have consistency about their thoughts, their words, and their actions.
Because all decisions and actions derive from that core.
That's exactly it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's easy. Like, think about Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. King. You know what he thought about a lot? Equality. You know what his words were about? Like, I have a dream about men and women being equality. And you know what his actions were about? He went and created rallies, and he created, you know, environments where people could activate on equality. That is so clean and crisp.
But most people don't have one core idea that drives them to that extent, right? Like, well, I'm interested in lots of things.
I think that that's accurate.
Yeah.
I think that's very accurate.
It's the rare individual who makes one idea their mission.
So he turned his philosophy into a mission. So his philosophy mm-hmm. was about equality. And then he had some other words that he would,
I got you.
Right? Yeah, and yeah. So let's do Malcolm X. His philosophy was also about equality, but the style in which he went about it was dramatically different. Yeah. So one's not right and wrong, but it's got to be right for you. You know, and so if we look at Gandhi, we look at Mother Teresa, we look at Rosa Parks, you know, we look at Helen Keller. You can find extraordinary people in the world. Jesus was very clear. Love. You know, it's pretty simple, right? Buddha was pretty simple. It's, you know, and I'm reducing like 2,000 year, 2,500 year old religions down to a word. That's not fair. But Buddhism like was loving kindness. Like all people are suffering. People suffer, so let's act in loving kindness. So the philosophy of loving kindness is the core principle.
Right.
You know, so, and I know I'm
no, I get it. I totally follow.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's already wonderful models, but I think it's time, like, put your funk on it. You know, what is yours? Mm-hmm. And so that's where you start. Listening, reading, exploring, writing. And so.
Come on, Michael. I don't have time for that.
Yeah. So just
tell me how to.
You just want to hack it?
I just want to find mastery. Come on. Tell me the five steps to mastery.
How about I give you your philosophy to life? Yeah. Is that what you do? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure you get this. So tell me, Michael, you sit down with all these high performers. Like, how do they do it? Yeah.
Wait, we're actually talking about it. Yeah, I know. Yeah. And they work their ass off and they recover. Uh-huh. You know, and they're pretty principle-based, most of them.
Let's talk about balance. Mm-hmm. Can we do that?
The mythical ridgeline of balance.
Yeah. What's your perspective on the conversation that swirls around the primacy or irrelevance of balance in the context of living authentically and performing at your potential?
I think balance is so overrated. You know, this concept, like the mythical ridgeline that one day I'll have balance. I don't know anyone that has balance. Mm-hmm. I don't have balance. And so I think it's way overrated. And the thought that you're supposed to have balance or that I'm supposed to have balance created incredible stress for me.
A lot of self-judgment.
Yeah. So I say, forget about it. That's what I say. I say, forget about this idea of balance and work on being present. Mm-hmm. And so
is there a different word like equanimity? Like, is there a different word that would capture?
You are so smart. Perhaps I don't really even know what that means.
I like to use it too. I don't know if I know what it means either.
Yeah, I think that maybe, but well, you know what balance conjures up is like, I've got the right balance in my life between work, between family life, between hobbies, between whatever. I don't know anyone that has that. I really don't. And so I think the way to inoculate that thought is to, one, just kind of square it up and say, is that really what I want? For me, that's not what I want. What I want is I want to be fully immersed in wherever I am with this incredible passion that feels right to me, like an inner fire that's alive in the moment. And you know how I know that that's what I want, or one of the things I want, is because when I'm tired, so when I'm fatigued or when I'm fearful, it doesn't come out. And that's, remember the story of me surfing? Mm-hmm. That's what happened. When I was so scared about the what could go wrong, this is early days, is that I couldn't go to the place of like that true, authentic expression, the creative, off-axis view of the world to be about it. And that's what you lit up for me in our first conversation. Like, yeah, like I think many of us have that, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel most alive when I'm completely immersed in something. And then because of that kind of social pressure and the conventional ideas around balance, then I start to sense guilt in myself and then self-judgment.
Shame and guilt.
Shame and guilt. Big one, you know?
Yeah. And then you've got another little thought that creeps in there, which is, man, this thing that I'm doing that I'm fully immersed in, it better be perfect.
Right.
I should be doing this
and not this.
Yeah. Psychologists are not funny people, but there's a joke. Stop shoulding on yourself. It smells, So like that word should, that's another challenge. Maybe we could do some sort of fun challenge with your community about, dropping the word should, dropping the word have to, gotta, musta, dropping those words because they create something that is less than. Mm-hmm. And so I should have. It leaves a residue of not being good enough. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no. I just say I love to go from thought to action.
Yeah.
So getting that kind of thing to actually happen for people is some of the more challenging parts.
I think that's a missing piece in this podcast adventure that I've been on. There's all the information, but there isn't enough. And there's takeaways and all that good stuff, but there isn't enough action steps.
So for you, I wanted to share this thought. For you, is the talk about it, walk about it piece, you living the search of self-discovery, the process of self-discovery, and living in an authentic way about it and not having all the answers, because people listen to you, like, oh my God, smart, talented, good looking, fill in the blanks. You're looking at me like I'm as screwed up as the next guy.
Yeah,
but like just being about it, that's really important. And I think that I realized early on that some folks would say to me, hey, can you just show up at the competition? And I didn't understand it. Now looking back, I understand. I just reminded them, like, hey, no matter what happens, like, it's good. Like, you're extraordinary as a human. Like, this is so much fun. What a gift to be able to lay it on the line. And that reminder that I don't need to be perfect. I just would show up that I didn't, mm-hmm. I don't know. That would happen long ago. You're doing that for hundreds of thousands of people. Hey, we're okay. let's keep learning and growing. So just going on the journey is an incredible, imprint on wellness, on performance. So I just want to say that out loud for you. So I've appreciated it.
I appreciate myself. That, man. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think, look, man, I'm just trying to figure it out like everyone else. You know what I mean?
Me too.
And and I don't have all the answers, but I can tell you I've learned a lot over the last 5 years. And I can't imagine my life without this podcast. It's been unbelievable. The exposure that it's given me and the audience to all these amazing minds that are doing incredible things. And when you said earlier, like, hey, I'm a fan of technology. It's like, look what technology allows us to do. Unfiltered. Without any middle person, to just connect with people who, look, we live in Los Angeles. We're amidst a community of all kinds of different people, but there's people all over the world that listen to your podcast and my podcast who feel alone in their communities and don't have the exposure to some of these people. So it's a gift. And when you talk about getting rid of the shoulds and the have to's, like, that's something I learned early on in recovery, is to banish those and replace them with the get. Like, I get to do this. I get to do this. And that's a very active way of practicing gratitude, bringing gratitude into your life.
So very applied way, mm-hmm. right? So you can say the concept or the thought and even back in all the science that would help support it. But until you practice it, it's not real.
Yeah.
It's just really not real. You know what? I have thought a solution. Maybe we'll dove this in later, is that, let's say the philosophy or something. So we're going to fire up this thing called Live in the Tribe. So we've got Finding Mastery Tribe. And it's a group of people that mm-hmm. are supporting and challenging each other. And so we're going to do Live in the Tribe. It's going to be on Facebook. But maybe we do something live, you and I. And we go on and we prime people, like when this conversation lands or when you air this conversation, and say in 3 days, 6 days or whatever, we figured this out together. And then we have a conversation live on the tribe together. And then that could be like whoever kind of like blows us away, or I don't know how to uh-huh. actually rate them, because I'm enamored with all of them. They're all equally good. So maybe it's a first person. Mm-hmm. I don't know what we do, you know, or the first person that got five people to do one with them. And so
I like that, man.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be fun?
That would be cool.
Yeah. So
well, what's really lighting me up about this whole thing is just the idea of moving into this more action oriented phase of activating people, you know, in a way that, you know, there's practices and tools that are actually available to people that can move the needle for them. I like that. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
I think we did it, dude. How long have we been going? We're an hour and a half. That's good, man.
Yeah. No, I was afraid that you and I were going to go for like 3 hours. And I was like, I'm not going to be that guy. I hope. Nah. Yeah. So thank you for the time.
That's good. Thank you, man. How you feel?
Great.
Feel good?
Yeah, thank you.
You ready to eat?
I am.
Let's eat, man. Thanks for coming out. So I'm ending this like it's my podcast, but I was going to say, if you want to connect with Michael, he's easy to find. Findingmastery.com.
.net.
That's right. Michael Gervais on Twitter and Instagram, and the Finding Mastery podcast, wherever you listen to fine podcasts. Check it out.
And I want to upload this on Finding Mastery as well. So check out Rich's podcast. If you haven't done it, make sure you're connected. Richroll.com. Mm-hmm. Is that right? And again, where all the podcast players are. And your Twitter handle is?
@RichRoll.
That's right. And Instagram as well.
Same thing.
It's easy when you got a cool name like that. So make sure you check it out. And the inspired conversations that are happening there are beautiful. And go back to the source of like why I even got into space was because Rich created an ecosystem where it felt wonderful to explore and to do it in a way that could be authentic. So thank you.
Yeah. And thank you for deciding to do it and taking it next level.
Let's go.
Continue to inspire me. So proud to be your friend.
Thank you.
All right. Peace, my friend. Until next time, we'll do it again soon.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.